Alberto and the other organizers for a very nice week. So I'll be presenting our efforts of describing hydrodynamic theory of fluctuating stripes or charge density waves. So this is very much work in progress, so any feedback or comments is more than welcome. And any complaints can be directed to my collaborators, who are probably not quite all in the room, but soon all going to be in the room. Okay, so a charge density wave phase of a system occurs when the charge density spontaneously forms this type of stripes, which spontaneously breaks translations in one direction. So it can be described by this type of expression. So I'll be focusing on the case where these stripes are incommensurate with the lattice. They have different wave vectors, because it's only in this case that the stripes truly spontaneously break translations. So this kind of charge density wave order can be probed experimentally with a variety of ways, for example, X-ray scattering or nuclear magnetic resonance. And in this experiment, X-rays were scattered off material, and so you measure the scatter product, and if you find a preferred wave vector in your scatter product, that's an indication of charge density wave order. So this type of order occurs in a large variety of materials, perhaps most interestingly in high-temperature superconductors, such as cuprates, where there can even be several charge density wave orders that coexist and that compete with the superconducting order. So I'll be describing the hydrodynamic regime of such a phase. So there'll be three parts to my presentation. First, I'll tell you about the hydro. So as I said, we're spontaneously breaking translations in one direction, so there's an extra Goldstone, kind of like in superfluids. And similarly to superfluids, this extra mode leads to a second sound, except we'll see that it's very different from superfluids in an important way. Then I'll talk about momentum relaxation due to disorder or a lattice. And we'll see that, unlike in the typical case where you weakly break translations, here we won't have Judah-type connectivities. It'll be a little more rich pole structure. And then finally, I'll talk about phase relaxation due to topological defects called dislocations. OK, so let's start with the hydro. So this is our ground state, which spontaneously breaks translations down to discrete translations. Okay, that's important because that means that our Goldstone will be a phase and not just a real number. And so that will play an important role when we talk about topological defects. So the Goldstone nonlinearly realizes translations. And the quantum version of this statement is just that it's canonical conjugate to the associated charge density, which is momentum density in the x direction. Okay. So this Goldstone phase is now a hydrodynamic variable, so we have to incorporate it in the hydro by putting it wherever we can in the considered relations under some symmetry constraints. So as for superfluids, the gradient of phi will be counted at zeroth order derivative in the derivative expansion. But the big difference with superfluids basically comes from the fact that the charge density wave phase flips under parity, under reversal of the x coordinate. And so because of that, so if you're familiar with superfluid hydrodynamics, basically wherever you the superfluid phase could appear in the considered relations, the CDW phase cannot, and vice versa. So for example, in superfluid hydrodynamics, we would have a contribution of grad phi to the current considered relation. Well, this is not allowed by parity here. And the leading contribution comes at the higher order in derivatives. But this term has just the right sign to appear instead in the stress tensor. OK, so we can go on and write down all these considered relations. Which should be either constrained by rotations if you're considering an isotropic state, or at least some reversals, some discrete symmetries if you're considering a nematic state. And I'll also be assuming time reversal symmetry. Okay. So to these considered relations, we add the usual conservation equations, okay, for charge and energy and momentum. And this leads to hydrodynamic equations of motion for the hydro variables, which are the charge density, energy density, and the momentum density. So except now we have an extra hydrodynamic variable, so we need a new equation of motion. Okay? For superfluids, this equation is called the Josephson relation. And there's an easy way to derive it. So if I turn on a chemical potential, it's going to couple to the charge density, which is conjugate to the superfluid phase. Right? And so if I calculate phi dot with this Hamiltonian, I'll get a contribution from the chemical potential. Then there'll be some higher derivative terms as well. So how does this work for charge density waves? Well, remember, the charge density wave phase is conjugate to momentum density in the x direction, which is sourced by the normal fluid velocity. Okay, and so the term that appears in this charge density wave Josephson relation is the normal velocity in the x direction. Here I wrote some examples of hydroactive corrections that you would add to the hydro. Notice, for example, here that this term, the coefficient of the grad mu, gamma 1, is constrained to be the same as that term over here. That's an example of an Onsager constraint due to time reversal symmetry.
Yeah. Yeah. If D were 2, could you have epsilon
D5
in J?
In J?
Epsilon XY,
DY? No, because it wouldn't have the right sign under reversal of the Y direction. JX is not supposed to flip. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, you could, the more I take symmetries away, the more I can add terms, but here I'll assume I have both reflections in the X and the Y direction. So your term is basically jx equals grad y phi, right? Yeah, so, so it's parity in the y direction. Okay, so now we have all the hydro equations and motions. And from this we can, in the usual way, get the Green's functions, the hydrodynamic Green's functions. And an interesting thing to study in these Green's functions is the pole structure. So there will always be as many small frequency poles as there are hydro variables. And these can be classified in diffusive modes or sound modes. So just to remind you, in regular hydrodynamics, let's say in two dimensions, there are two diffusive modes. One is carried by the transverse momentum, and one is carried by this combination of charge. And then there's one sound mode carried by energy density and longitudinal momentum. This is called first sound. Okay? And so it's well known that when you add a superfluid phase to the picture, it will couple with charge and lift the diffusive mode to make a new sound mode called second sound. Okay? So something similar happens for CDWs, except remember, whatever can happen for a superfluid can't happen for a CDW. So instead of coupling with charge density, it's going to couple with the other diffusive mode, and similarly, you know, lift it to create a second sound mode. So it leaves the diffusive charge untouched. So we'll focus on these five modes. The most basic question you can ask is, what are the speeds of sounds? So the answer for first sound is very simple. If here you ignore the rho phi term, this is a CDW correction. Let's turn the CDW off. Then this is just the usual speed of sound in hydrodynamics, right? Energy density plus pressure over momentum susceptibility. And when I turn on the CDW, it gives an anisotropic correction to the speed of sound. Okay, and so that correction vanishes. So if I have a sound wave propagating in the y direction, that wave won't know that translations are spontaneously broken in the x direction. Okay, the correction is largest in the x direction, which kind of makes sense. So the second sound, however, is much more dramatically anisotropic, and in fact, the speed of sound vanishes both in the x and y direction. So the mode, in fact, looks diffusive, right? The poles collapse to the imaginary axis there. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about the unperturbed hydrodynamics. Now I'll start considering what we can, you know, how we can perturb it. So let's start with momentum relaxation. So as you probably all know, if a system at finite density has conserved momentum, it inevitably has an infinite DC conductivity. And the reason is that at finite density, current carries a bit of momentum, and that momentum can't decay. So part of the current cannot decay. So we'll have a zero frequency pole in the conductivity. And the usual story when momentum is weakly relaxed, when translations are weakly broken, is that this zero frequency pole is lifted to some finite frequency scale, which characterizes the relaxation rate of momentum. So this is kind of the opposite regime as what Andrew McKinsey was talking about earlier. Here I have hydrodynamics with translations. So the electron mean free path is very small, but I'm assuming that translations are a good symmetry, approximately. And so this type of expression leads to a Judah type connectivity. Okay, but for charge density waves, the story is a bit different, and the reason is that momentum there plays a special role because it's spontaneously broken in the original unperturbed phase. So when I'm explicitly breaking translation invariance, not only do I give a finite lifetime to momentum, I also give the Goldstones a mass, right? Because they're now Goldstones of an approximate symmetry, so it's just like for pions. And so the pole structure reflects this and looks a bit different, and the connectivities look qualitatively different. So this type of kind of qualitative expression has been known for a long time. Not quite Russian in the 60s long, but still quite long. But one thing we can add to the story is a quantitative expression for this relaxation rate using the memory matrix. So for a given translation breaking mechanism, for a given turn in the Hamiltonian here, I'm assuming that some operator of my theory is coupled to inhomogeneous potential, which could model disorder or a lattice. The memory matrix gives a formula for the relaxation rate in terms of a two-point function of this operator. Okay, and this formula, as was discussed before, is perturbative in the momentum breaking. So I'm always assuming that momentum is only weakly broken. So this type of expressions have been used in a variety of contexts, and so it would also hold for it can also be used for to compute the relaxation rate here. Okay, but something that's even more specific to charge density waves is phase relaxation, and the reason is that charge density waves have an extra operator, which is conserved in the unperturbed state, and whose conservation protects zero frequency poles. And this operator is basically the total winding in the x direction of the charge density wave phase, which in some sense measures the compression of the lines, right? So if this is a state with zero winding, then this would be a state with some positive winding. And so unlike for momentum, the conservation of this operator does not lead to infinite DC connectivities. So as the plots before, I just relaxed momentum and I had finite connectivities. So this operator is not protecting infinite DC connectivities because it can't carry current. And the reason is simply that the winding current susceptibility has to be zero by either parity or time reversal symmetry. So instead, it's linked to some different observables. It's not directly tied to thermoelectric transport. So this leads to two questions. First of all, can this operator be relaxed? And if so, what physics controls the associated relaxation scale? Let's call it gamma prime. And second of all, since it's not directly related to thermoelectric transport, at least in a simple way, what is a good, experimentally accessible observable where this gamma prime would appear? And just a little side comment. So in superfluids, there's a very similar operator, actually formally exactly the same operator, but it has a different interpretation. Here it's the supercurrents, which, so this operator can carry current for superfluids, and its relaxation controls the pole structure of connectivity. So you'll hear more about this in Les's talk tomorrow or Friday or whenever it's rescheduled. Okay, so good. So the relevant concept that is important for this relaxation rate is topological defects. So phi is a phase, and as such, it can have vortices. And vortices for the phase phi are called dislocations. So basically, it corresponds to when a charge density wave line terminates or splits into two. Okay, this is an experimental picture of this. And so when this happens, the phase phi winds has a 2 pi winding, or more than 2 pi, around this dislocation. And so the gradient of the phase becomes larger and larger as I approach the dislocation, right? Until at some point it's so costly energetically that the system just prefers to restore the normal symmetric phase. So that near the dislocation core, we're in the symmetric phase again, and there's no Goldstone. Okay, but this means that our operator that we defined here, integral of the phase over the whole sample, is not really well defined, right? So the best we can do in defining such a winding operator is integrate over everywhere where phi exists. In other words, over the whole sample minus the dislocation course. And it turns out that this operator is not quite conserved. So it's easy to see that this term in the Hamiltonian will not commute with W. So it looks a little weird, but remember, T0x is just the momentum density, which is conjugate to phi. So this is basically, this would come from a kinetic term for phi in the effective action, okay? And in fact, so it's definitely there in the Hamiltonian, we even know it's prefactor. Here I wrote it in terms of a susceptibility. And so you can compute the commutator of this with W, you'll get this type of expression. So an integral over the dislocation cores of the momentum density here. So if there's no dislocations, this would just be zero. So now that I have an expression for W dot, or the mechanism that kind of causes a W dot, I can put it in our favorite memory matrix formula to obtain an expression for the relaxation rate. Okay, so I'll just plug this in that formula, and up to some geometric factors, we'll get a momentum Green's function. Okay, and here it's evaluated at k core. So this is the wavelength or the wave vector associated with the size of a dislocation. Okay, and this factor of k squared is coming from these derivatives in front. So now if we want to go further, we need a way to evaluate this Green's function. Okay, and notice that this is an operator that exists in the cores of the dislocation. So this is a Green's function in the normal symmetric state without a CDW. Okay, and so this, we need to know something about the normal states, and depending on the nature of dislocations, it might be different from some material to another. But there's a case that's particularly simple. It's if the dislocations are sufficiently large so that I can actually do hydrodynamics within the dislocations. Okay, in that case, I can just do regular hydrodynamics without a CDW in the dislocations to get this Green's function. So basically, I'm assuming that K core is smaller than the hydro cutoff, so that I can use hydro Green's functions here. And if I do that, so momentum diffuses in hydro, as we saw with Mike's talks, and the diffusion constant is related to the shear viscosity. And so basically, we get a formula for the relaxation rate, which is inversely proportional to the shear viscosity. Here, A core is just the area of a dislocation, and this is the density of dislocations in the sample. So now that we have a formula for this relaxation rate, the remaining question is, how do you measure it? So as we saw, it's not direct. It doesn't directly control thermoelectric transport. I mean, it does affect it in a way, but much less dramatically than weak momentum relaxation does. Instead, it's more closely tied to stress. Right? We saw it was like it relaxes the compression of a charge density wave, and so a simple experimentally accessible observable that's sensitive to that is sound, or more precisely, sound attenuation. And it indeed turns out that both of our sound modes precisely get attenuated with an attenuation proportional to this relaxation rate. So there's a few caveats before I can go to an experimentalist and tell him about this. So first of all, experimentally, when people measure sound attenuation, they basically shake the lattice, so it's more phonon sound mode that they're measuring the attenuation of. And so one will have to see how these phonon sound modes couple to the hydrodynamics and feels the various relaxation rates, or feels the dislocations. And second of all, there's several competing effects that would also lead to attenuation. For example, momentum relaxation also attenuates things, but not in a way that should be dramatically stronger than this gamma prime. So if you have a very clean sample, for example, it's reasonable to think that this gamma prime would be the dominant attenuation. And of course, all these sound modes do have also a small diffusive part, which is proportional to k squared, right? They're not exactly on the real axis. So this might be experimentally a little difficult to separate from gamma prime. But we're still optimistic. OK, that's I think I'm just in time. That's all I have for you today. Thanks for your attention.
And do you know of an experimental system where you have this fluctuating stripes, where it's just, it's just the phase that's fluctuating and not the amplitude?
Let's see.
I mean, I'm thinking of a superfluid analogy.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So basically, you're asking if generically there would be other relaxations due to the amplitude fluctuating instead.
I'm quite ignorant, so I'm just asking. Like in the Cooper rate, you said there was there's quite a lot of. Do you know if you can get into the regime where the phase is fluctuating?
Yeah. So I'm not sure when the amplitude fluctuations would you can completely ignore them. I mean, it's probably a similar story where you would need the kind of density, so what I called rho phi, which is the kind of the density associated with charge density waves, to be small, so that amplitude, it's not too costly for amplitude to, for the phase to fluctuate. Okay. But I'm not exactly sure what experimental systems maybe.
Well, I mean, I don't know an experimental system, but I know where you can look. So there's a huge red log fizz by Steve Kielsen and Eduardo Fradkin on fluctuating stripe models and experiments in the cube rates. Uh-huh. So the answer is, if it's not in there, it's probably not known.
Okay. Thanks.
So said at the beginning that if the period here is commensurate, if the wavelength is commensurate with the lattice, you don't break something. So is there any sign of this meaning? Is there a limit you can take of the results and see what happens in that limit?
Yeah, exactly. So the reason I said this is that if it's completely commensurate with the lattice, then clearly the lattice has a say on what's happening, and the charge density didn't really pick a wave vector. But this is called pinning. In that case, you could strongly pin the charge density wave. But there is a limit, a weak pinning limit, where I think even for maybe some commensurate cases where the effect of the lattice, although it kind of picked the direction of the charge density wave, it doesn't completely pin it. And so this would be within our regime of weak momentum relaxation. So you would have a lattice that, the charge density wave feels the lattice a little bit.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you again.